At us right now is a legend in the music biz. His name, Jim Messina. And of course, you remember that name from Poco and Loggins and Messina, Buffalo Springfield. He's been involved with many, many projects, and we'll talk to him about that right here on PMP Network. And welcome to the show, Jim.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Well, it's my pleasure to be asked. It's a little early for me, but then again, I got a 5-year-old daughter, so we get up at least around 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah, well, there you go. I remember those days. Now I get up for other reasons. When you get old, you start getting up a little in the middle of the night, but that's another story.
You get up to eat.
Yeah, well, that's not what I get up for, but that's okay. We won't get into it. But anyway, it's a pleasure to have you, and it's an interesting story that you have. I was reading your biography, and I guess your parents were divorced when you were young, when you were a baby, and you lived with both parents at different times, and both had different types of music that they enjoyed, and your dad, I guess, was a guitarist. So I would assume he had a little bit more impact on your musical career just because of that.
Oh, absolutely. I used to love to watch him play. I think I look back at how, I was... brought into the idea of even being in music. It was, it was Dad playing the guitar. I felt he was always better than I am. He had one of these abilities to sit down and play like Merle Travis, and the fingerstyle picking was just, really, it was really great and very inspiring.
How old were you when he taught you how to play it?
I was about 5 when he started putting my hands around the strings, and then, of course, when he'd go to work, especially in the summer, I dragged the guitar out and sat around and tried to figure out what it was that he showed me.
Yeah. Can you speak up just a little bit louder?
Sure.
We're getting a low reading here.
Absolutely.
When you were brought up, on music like Elvis and Ricky Nelson and people like that?
Yeah. On my mother's side of the family, there was, she was into, Elvis Presley and Ricky Nelson. She's also into, the race music, they called it in those days, which is, rhythm and blues. And she was, child of the 40s, so, it was the big band era for her. So when the 50s came in, that was a change. She was only 18 years older than I am. So she had a, she was young enough to appreciate the 50s when that period was coming in, so that music was in the house too.
Yeah.
And then her husband was really into, country western music, Johnny Cash, and that whole movement that was happening in music. So there was a lot of Ernest Tubb and Snow. What was his name? Remember something Snow? Hank Snow. Hank Williams, all of that stuff was in the house. And then on my father's side, he was more into the country swing, Spade Coolies and Bob Wills and the Texas Playboy, stuff like that. So there was a lot of music from country to rock in my household, which is, it doesn't surprise me now in looking back why country rock was something that Richie and I coined and created in our 20s.
Do you, when you look back, did you realize, even when you were in high school, that music was going to be what you were going to do?
Well, when I was in high school, I started fairly, at an early age. I was like 13 and a half when I entered high school. And I already had a band, when I was 12. So music wasn't necessarily the consideration of what I was doing. What I was going to do, it was what I was doing. Whether or not I could make a living at it was, was the question. But, I made enough money all through high school to bought my car and paid for my insurance and my gas and all that stuff. So I realized that with what I was getting as far as work, I could take care of most of what I needed. It was once I graduated, can I actually pay my rent? And that was a struggle at first, but I was able to overcome that by, when I first came to Hollywood in my high school year, making records. I had been asked by a man by the name of Glenn Edwards, who was a DJ who had a small record company, if I would, you know, produce some records for him, I didn't even know what that meant, and had to be, you know, had to ask him, what do you want me to do? So he says, you just do what I ask you to do, and came into Hollywood, and I started working in the studio and organizing the arrangements of the bands that were, you know, sloppy, and put all that together, made some records for him. And then during that period of time, there was a recording engineer that worked at a recording studio called Emperor Productions, and that was owned by a man who was a DJ at KRLA, which was Bob Hudson. And Mike Durow was the engineer who has now become a multimillionaire in design for, you know, equipment for radio station stuff. He was a technical engineer as well as a mixing engineer, and it was he who took me under his wing and began to teach me the ins and outs of the recording engineering side of things. So I apprenticed under him, and it was shortly after 5-6 months or so that I worked with him that I started getting jobs in the recording industry, as first as a dubbing engineer making dubs for publishing companies, and then going on learning how to mix and set up studios. And that began my career as a recording engineer, which is really what fed me in the early days before I started producing Buffalo Springfield.
I was going to say that, but didn't you during that time work with groups like The Doors and Lee Michaels and Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass and things?
Well, some of that is yes and no. Lee Michaels, I engineered his record, that's for sure. The Doors, I used to sit in and just do second engineering sometimes when Bruce Botnick, who was actually their recording engineer, was either ill or just overworked. The Tijuana Brass was not anything that I had anything to do with, really. That was, I don't know how that has gotten into my bio, but I've been trying to get that out for years. I worked at the studio where the Tijuana Brass recorded, and again, that was Bruce Botnick's work.
See, I actually got that from your own website.
And I'm trying to figure out how that's gotten on there. I've taken it off a couple of times. But thank you for reminding me of it.
But so then later on, were you engineering Buffalo Springfield before you became a member?
Yes. I engineered their second album, which was Buffalo Springfield Again. And then on their third album, I started engineering that record for them when their bass player got busted, Bruce. And I auditioned for the part along with about 10 or 15 other bass players, and they realized that I was better at it than anyone else did. And the reason why is I used to, you know, mix it. I knew the parts, you know, in my brain, so it was easy for me to pull that stuff out. And then later they needed a producer, and Ahmed Erdogan came to me and said, listen, they're having problems, you know, trusting a new producer to come in at this point. They like working with you. They trust you. Would you be willing to do the job? And so then I accepted it. And at that point, I was their engineer, bass player, and producer.
Wow. You know, it's interesting when you look back at Buffalo Springfield. Most people only know them for what it's worth, which was a massive hit and has been seen in numerous movies and things since then. But they made some incredible music that didn't chart any, top any charts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Steven, in my opinion, was really the singer and the songwriter who had, I think at the time, the most depth in terms of being able to write rock and roll and folk and, you know, whatever area you wanted to be able to shape it in. But, you know, he was a great singer and a great songwriter and truly innovative as a guitarist. You know, Neil had kind of brought the, I would say, the grunge or the funk, I'd say more grunge, mm-hmm. into the music, but also added a melodic sense that I think together is what shaped, you know, what Buffalo Springfield was. And then with Richie's voice in there as the energy and the singer and the singing the harmonies and sometimes leads, gave it the strength, I think. But very, very talented people, all very inspired and very motivated to do the best that they could in those days.
What was it that you and Richie Furay and Rusty Young wanted to do with Poco? I mean, what was the, you left Buffalo Springfield and Poco was the next stop. What was it that that turned you guys on that you wanted to do with that band that you couldn't do with Buffalo Springfield?
Well, I can only speak for myself because it's hard to truly know what was in the other minds. But it started out first with me working on the Buffalo Springfield album and working with Richie, because Stephen was quite capable of taking care of himself. He knew who he wanted to play with, and he was writing his songs and arranging them in the way he wanted to do it. So was Neil, but Richie wasn't really a musician in the sense that he really knew his instrument and the chords and how to write charts or who to call, or he was the one who needed probably the most work. So in the process of finishing up one of his songs, Kind Woman, I had suggested that we find a steel player, and the roadie who was working with us at the time, Miles Thomas, said he had some friends that he knew in Colorado where he'd grown up, a guy named Rusty Young, who was really a good steel player. So we flew him in, and at the time I was recording his instrument on Kind Woman, Richie and I were in the we're in the control room and we're listening to this, and we both kind of felt, wow, this is really great. And it was at that moment that I felt that maybe there was something that Richie, well, I'll put it this way, there was something that for me there beyond what the Buffalo Springfield was that I felt motivated from. And then once that record was finished and we were out promoting the last Buffalo Springfield album on tour, which I don't think had been released yet. We had some days with the Beach Boys, and that was about 3 days before Martin Luther King was assassinated. So when we hit the South, we hit it during a very, very troubled time, which was, I think, part and parcel was one of the problems why the Buffalo Springfield didn't go any further than that. It was just a lot of dates were canceled. There was a lot of fear on the street. The attendance was not as high as that both the Beach Boys and we had hoped it would be. Mm. And had that had been a successful period of time, I think that the Buffalo Springfield maybe would have probably gone on for another year, and one of the songs off of that album might have had a chance to make it. But given those circumstances, it was during that time that Richie and I realized that the group was going to break up. Neil had already, quit a couple of times, and it just was not stable. I mean, when I look back now at a modern way of looking at it, I can certainly see that the group was dysfunctional, and there was just too much drama and people going in different directions. And I think that was just mainly because they were young. I mean, come on, they were in their early 20s and struggling, musicians living in a town that eat you up. So I think Richie and I, in a backseat of a cab once, either in Nashville or wherever, we were going to Gruen Guitars or something, and we thought, maybe we could do something that has, instead of being folk rock, maybe we it would be country rock, based on what we were starting to see with Richie's music. And I was ready to get off the bass guitar. I was really a guitarist and had been playing bass in the Buffalo Springfield just to, be able to fit in, make a living. So that session, Kind Woman, I think was probably the motivating force that moved both Richie and I into the idea, after the Springfield had broken up, to form Poco. From that point, we called Rusty and asked him to come out, and said he had a drummer named George, and so the two of them came out and we started playing together, and we all liked each other. And the next step was to try to find a bass player to replace me on bass so I could play guitar. And that's when we started looking and found Randy Meisner, who was in the Stone Country band with Ricky Nelson. And Ricky was not going out that much, and so we offered Randy a steady job, and he took it.
So all these people, like Meisner, of course, ended up in the Eagles. And we all know what happened with Stephen and Neil. Had a very, Amazing career. Now, yeah. Pogo had many notable songs. Crazy Love and Heat of the Night are the ones that stand out for me.
Right.
But
one was You Better Think Twice. That's a song that I wrote before I left, and that was the first charted single we had.
Oh. Ah. Yeah, I remember the song now, but it didn't come to me quickly when I was thinking of Pogo. But.
Well, it wouldn't, because I was there a year. The song got on the charts. It got us the opportunity to make another record there, and then I left. So it was You Better Think Twice was, had I had stayed all those years, it would probably be one of the ones that are there. But when a band member leaves, nobody wants to play a song.
Yeah, well, that's true. Now, after that, though, after you left, you became a producer and actually signed a 6-album production deal with Columbia. And I guess your first project was a guy named Kenny Loggins, and the rest is history.
Right.
What happened when you first met singer-songwriter Kenny Loggins were supposed to just produce his record?
Well, I asked him, I was asked while I was still producing or am traveling with Pogo to meet with him, and I told the guys, his brother, Danny Loggins and Don Ellis, who were the two who approached me originally, that I needed to wait till I got off this tour and back home, but to, send me some tapes. But Kenny didn't have any tapes. He hadn't recorded anything, and so he decided we'd meet in person and just talk. So I asked him if he have any music to play, and he says, not really. And I said, well, how about this? I have a guitar here. Why don't you play me some of your songs? And that's kind of how it started, which was a turnoff to me, because he just didn't have his stuff with him like I had anticipated, so we could listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just said, here's a guitar, and I turned on the tape recorder that I had, a stereo tape recorder in there. I said, here, sing your songs. And so he sang about 7 or 8 songs in a row, and I listened to them, and we had dinner and talked a little bit, and then he left. And kind of what went through my mind is I realized that he had some very sweet songs like House at Pooh Corner and Danny's Song and stuff like that, but he wasn't really a rock and roll, high energy kind of guy. He was more of a folk singer. Then my first impression was, we're moving out of folk music. And in fact, Richie and I had already done that with Pogo, and that was 3 years prior. Is there any are there any legs here? And so it took me a while to think about it, because he didn't have a manager, he didn't have an attorney, he didn't have a business manager, he'd never really been in the business. And I realized that if I took on this project, it was going to be a lot of work, because just to produce a record and then leave it alone, I knew that it would go nowhere. It might have a little bit of help from the record company, but in those days, the only way you could really make something happen was by putting a group together and touring behind your record, because the record company in those days would put out the money to support that process.
Right.
Because they wanted to sell records, and they had connections, and you had in-house publicists, and you had in-house promotion men, and you could utilize the company, to promote your product without having to spend it yourself. So I knew what was needed, and the question was, did I want to invest the time in him? So after, some careful deliberation and talking to him and letting him know what was in for it and what he needed, and I began working with him and then trying to find, the team to put together for him. I went through managers and agents and had no luck until I finally, after a number of months of rehearsing him, I rehearsed him in my father-in-law's guest house, which was up in Mulholland, and I allowed him to utilize, my instruments. And through my relationships with other musicians like Merle Bergani and Larry Sims, who had been in a group called the Sunshine Company, who I had worked with Pogo, and then Al Garth lived below me in an apartment building. And then after having auditioned John Clark, I was able to get a band together for him, and then began to see the pieces sort of shape up. And then after more rehearsals and actually giving him some of my songs and and taking some of his arrangements and up, making them upbeat and more rock and roll, which you'll see Sitting In is really is probably the hallmark piece for what all those rehearsals were in the beginning. That's what was sort of created to get him going. But without the stage experience and without the ability to run a band and to deal with managers and agents, I just thought it would be like throwing the Christians into the lion,
Well, together, as you guys went on to record 9 albums in 7 years and sell 14 million of them.
That's right.
Wow. And, of course, many of them, I still walk around sometimes singing Your Mama Don't Dance and Your Daddy Don't Rock and Roll. It's a lot of catchy tunes that that you guys recorded over the many years. In terms of the songwriting, did both of you work together for the most part, or did you guys do your own thing?
Well, we did our own thing mainly. There were songs that, and I think I was well advised. My attorney at the time said to me, he says, you know, it really would inure to both of your best interests if the two of you collaborated on songs. And he says, if you find you're working on a song and it's taking too long, maybe you should bring it to Kenny and encourage him to, do the same. So I brought him a tune that I was working on called Your Mama Don't Dance, and it was mostly done, and Kenny helped me, finish it up, and we kind of got it done, and while we were waiting for some guys to show up, the rest of the guys, which turned out to be very successful for us. And then I had another song I was working on called Angry Eyes, which I had actually pulled the lick from a movie I had done a couple of years prior and sort of rearranged it and got it going and had some thoughts and ideas, lyrics, and brought it to him, and Kenny helped me finish it. And then he brought me a song called Watching the River Run that needed some lyrics, which I helped him to finish. So, and we probably did those three plus my music, I'm not sure what else we did, but all the songs that we co-wrote together were always very, they were crowd pleasers,
Thinking of You is another one, I think.
No, he didn't write that, but that's something I wrote, but that was a single release.
Yeah, it was a good song, too. You guys had so many hits over the years. It was amazing. But what was it that eventually had you guys going your own way? Because I know you made a bunch of solo albums yourself in the 80s.
Well, it started out as, to produce Kenny as a solo artist, and I think he always had that in his mind. And I think after 3, 4, 5 years of us working together and the stress that's involved with all of that, he was beginning to musically, have other ideas and go in a different direction. And quite honestly, I was getting exhausted having done Poco, Springfield, and Log in the Scene. About 10 years of my life of just straight stress. It was time for me to take a break.
Well, we only have like 5 more minutes left here, so I want to get to something that's really important for folks out there who are interested in songwriting. And, there's no better way to learn it than from a guy who's, someone like you. You offer a 6-day intensive workshop, and I wanted to ask you about it. It's in California. It's from February 5th to the 12th.
Right.
And it's a pretty interesting situation. What exactly do you do, and how much personal attention do you give to all the people who come?
Well, what I do is not to teach people how to write hit songs. What I do is to help people facilitate their ability to get inside themselves and find the words and the ways in which to express what they're feeling. And the process that I've developed has really evolved over the years, and it's I explain to them how we can get inside to our emotional bodies, I call it, and show them how it is, where it comes from, how it goes to the feeling state of our bodies, into the imaginary where it splits into the thoughts, and how we then put words and sounds to the verbal part of what goes on, and then how the listener receives it, which is very much the same way. I spend a great deal of time you know, with everybody, depending on the size of the workshop. I never go over 20. That's as many as I can, you know, do and get to everybody. But we start off first with looking at their lyrics, and then looking at how the melodies are connected to the lyric, and then how they put together the music to the lyric. And with a, you know, with the rest of the participants, they're able to reflect back what it is that they're hearing when somebody recites a lyric, and it gives each person an opportunity without criticism. I don't allow criticism or comments about whether something's good or bad or indifferent. It's more about, you know, what do you think or feel the song is about, and reflect that about, so that the writer has an opportunity, a unique opportunity, to hear from a multitude of people in the workshop what they believe their song is about. And the idea is to get them to the point to where they can have a predictable outcome in terms of how their songs are received, whether or not they're connecting with the melodies, whether or not they are, you know, getting the music across. Part of that then moves into the performance part of the workshop, where I work with each person individually to see what it is that they're struggling with. Sometimes it's fear, you know, stage fright. Sometimes it's just, you know, showing them that they need to come more prepared. Sometimes they don't know their lyrics. Sometimes they're singing a song too high. They're singing it in the wrong key. Sorting out all those aspects of it so that when they get on that stage, they know they have sung this song before. They know how people are going to respond to it. They know they're in the right key. They know they're connecting with the melody. And then from that standpoint, it's really, you know, up to them to now be able to take the tools that I give them to be able to get up on stage, perform the music, or walk into an office where someone's going to hear their song or audition live, and they have their comfort zone. They're now prepared to stand in front of an audience and deliver.
Have you had an instance yet where you saw someone that was so talented you wanted to produce them yourself?
Well, Kenny Loggins.
Yeah.
Richie Furay. Yeah, yeah, there are, you know, as far as producing acts and stuff, I don't... My object when I'm in that room is not to see what is there for me. That has nothing to do with it.
Right.
I even let everybody know we signed an agreement when we go in that nobody has any right to anybody's song. If they come up with ideas, you give them away for free. So if you have a good idea, don't share it, because you're not going to get a piece of it. That is a totally safe environment where people are able to speak and sing and become whoever they are. I'm not there to find the next new, you know, star, or to find the greatest songs that I can publish. That's exactly the opposite of the purpose and the model. But there are very talented people in there. There was one gentleman who came in one of my workshops down in South Carolina who was just, I mean, extremely talented. Great voice, great songs. But again, some of these people, you know, they have a tendency to get in their own way. So, and I've had others that have gone out of the workshop, and many that have started a career in recording their CDs and becoming songwriters. And, you know, my object is to help them become better at what they do and more comfortable.
I got a minute left here. I want to just give people information on how they can get a hold of Jim Messina. If you would like to meet him in person and actually have him work with you on your career, you can do that. It's 1-805-686-1862. That's 805-686-1862. Or you can email... where is it now? I'm looking for the... Well, you can actually go to the website, which is jimmessina.com.
jimmessina.com.
And there's a workshop/workshop that you can get all the information that's right on there. And there's also information on the LSL Guest Ranch and Resort, which is where things are happening. And I guess that you can actually get reservations there as well. So it's a wonderful program, and I wish I could go myself. I would love to do that because I write poetry, and I would love to be able to learn how to kind of put it together. But I can't do that. But you can, folks. So the number again is 805-686-1862. And Jim, thanks so much for coming on PNP Network.
My pleasure, and have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.